91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with marine biologist, ecologist, and author Dr. Carl Safina. His newest book shows the key similarities in how humans and animals think and feel. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Do animals exhibit empathy and compassion? Can they plan ahead? Carl Safina examines how non-human consciousness, cognition, and emotion influence the lives of animals in his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Elephants keep track of hundreds of others. Ravens may be as bright as chimps. Killer whales sustain vocal contact with others spread over 150 miles. Our guest also hosts Saving the Oceans with Carl Safina. We return with that interview after the news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. 8 minutes past 1 o'clock on this Monday. Good afternoon to you, Bonnie. We have a great program in store today.
We do. On our Monday edition, we discuss animal behaviors and their emotional lives with Dr. Carl Safina. He's a marine biologist, ecologist, conservationist, award-winning author, and PBS television host.
What was the name of his TV program?
Saving the Ocean.
Right, and that's still under production, I believe. Well, Carl Safina is also a MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellow and a faculty member at Stony Brook University. His latest book is Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel.
And he joins us from Stony Brook, New York. Welcome, Carl Safina.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You start your book with a profound question about who an animal is, not what it is, not what it does or doesn't do, but who it is and why. And yet you tell us that scientists usually steer firmly away from questions about the inner lives of animals. Why is that the case?
Because when scientists first started studying animal behavior, we didn't know anything about the inner lives of animals. And so people had projected things like foxes are clever and grasshoppers are lazy and all these things that we created as caricatures from fables. So they needed to establish a real science and strip away all of the caricature. So they said, look, we really can only see what the animal does, and that will be our science, and we don't have any way of understanding anything about mental experience, so we just won't go there. And it turns out that that is not the case anymore. That was the case 60 or 70 years ago when people started trying to develop a science of animal behavior. But since then, we have lots of different things that we've learned about how the brain works, about the behavior of free-living animals, about neurochemistry, lots and lots of things. People didn't even really start watching wild animals in any kind of scientific way until the 1960s. So we have an enormous amount that we now know that we didn't know before.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that knowing what we do know now about their inner lives and the fact that many people don't admit to the fact that that they exist, do you think it's willful ignorance, or do humans somehow maybe subconsciously fear finding out that animals do possess thoughts and feelings much like ours and that we're not unique and it gives us license to kill them and treat them whatever way we want?
The shortest answer is yes, you're right. And the idea that we are categorically special and absolutely in a class of our own is our favorite story. So the idea that animals don't have any thoughts or any emotions is a way that we really reinforce that story easily. I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of people simply accept it. Another thing is that if they don't have any thoughts or feelings, you don't have to care about what they think or what they feel when you're doing anything you want to them. So it just makes it easy for us to flatter ourselves and not worry about things as far as what we do with animals. And I think that those are the two reasons why this idea persists, that we're the only ones that are aware or conscious or can think or have any emotions or anything like that. But people who watch wild animals, or many people who simply have pets, know that it's an absurd thing to think, that all of the evidence of all kinds is firmly in support of the idea that animals, which we know all have brains very similar to ours and all have sensory organs very similar to ours, have perceptions very similar to ours.
That was my next question, to talk about this scientific indifference to emotions and psyches of animals. I mean, anyone who has a dog like I have had knows how perceptive and emotional they are.
Yes, so it's a strange thing that there are still so many people who are so confused about that.
What I get a little confused about myself is how we know the difference between when we're truly in touch with what animals actually think and feel and when we're projecting or anthropomorphizing. That's kind of a difficult, it's kind of blurry, that line, do you think?
Well, the same could be said about me trying to understand you or you trying to understand me. The first shot that we take is we assume that we are similar, and the second thing is we try to find out what's really going on, and it's a little bit of a two-step process. Of course, it the line is blurry. So with other animals, because they see with their eyes, they hear with their ears, they smell with their noses, and they have a lot of the same main concerns that we have, which is food and water, mates and safety, a knowledge of where they live and how to get around it. So they have all of those things, and it's very reasonable for your first guess to be that they are perceiving as we would perceive if we were them. But then you can watch them to see if that really makes sense and if that's really right. So it can be helpful to project, but you can't know for sure until you spend some time really watching or getting to know animals and see how they seem to be making sense of the world. So a good example of this is we know that elephants have tremendously strong family bonds and that they stay together with their female elephants are the leaders of family groups, and they stay together with their adult daughters and all of the daughters' children. But the adult males do not travel with the females or their family groups. So if you see these elephants acting like they love one another and seeking reassurance and seeking the proximity of the ones that are in their family or acting toward other families that they know well as if they are friends, it's quite reasonable to say that these elephants actually love each other. They have these deep, deep bonds that lasts for decades. So your first guess turns out to be right once you watch them for a long time, as scientists have done. If your first guess about two elephants that you see mating is that they are in love, well, all you need to do is watch them for a few minutes, and what you learn is that the males go off. The males do not form any long-term bonds with the females. The males do not provide any parental care. So they are interested in mating, but they don't have anything that we would call romantic love because they don't stay together as a pair. So your first guess is a useful tool because in many ways other animals make sense of the world in the ways that we make sense of the world. But then you do have to actually watch and get familiar with them to try to really learn what's going on with them.
Let me have your guess on this, Carl Safina. I had two Dobies that were very attached to each other, constant companions for years. When one was finally ill enough and I finally had to take him to the vet and put him down, there was very little reaction from the female when I returned without him. And that was she yet perceptive enough to know perhaps that I, what had been done, that it was for his own good that he was gone? Or did she just not miss him, do you think?
It strikes me as unusual that a dog would not miss another dog that mm-hmm. they lived with.
Outwardly, there was no behavior. There wasn't any...
Yeah. Well, the definition of grief that I use in the book, which is sort of similar to the definition I was working my way around to, but I like this one because I didn't come up with it and because it's nice and succinct, is from a writer named Barbara J. King. And she says that grief is, she's written about grief in other species, and she says that grief is when a companion has died and the survivor alters its routine, looks for, calls for the companion, searches for them, and isn't on the same eating schedule and just basically goes off their routine. So you seem not to have seen any sign of grief in your dog.
At least in my perception.
Yeah,
right.
So maybe there was something else going on internally that you didn't perceive. That's very hard to know since you didn't see an outward sign of it. One of the ways that we understand that other animals have minds is that we see the logic of their minds in the workings of their behavior. Or you could say you see the workings of their minds in the logic of their behavior. But you didn't see that in the behavior in this case. I've seen other dogs and some other animals respond to a missing companion in the way that Barbara J. King defines as grief. A lot of searching for them, a lot of calling for them, looking all around the place for them. We have two dogs, and on the 4th of July this year, we happened to be unavoidably out of the house for about 5 or 6 hours in the evening, making an unanticipated trip to a hospital. So while we were there at the hospital saying, boy, this is taking a lot longer than we expected, and our dogs are going to be really terrified by all the fireworks, mm-hmm. It got dark. It got to be almost 11 p.m. by the time we got home. And our dogs have electric collars, so they have an electric fence around the property, but no physical fence. And one of the dogs, who we knew is the one who really is frightened by fireworks, he could not be found. But the other one seemed really agitated. And, you know, we were calling the one. She knows when we call the other one by name. They know each other's names. And she seemed to be looking all around. We were looking all around. She seemed to understand that we were looking for him, and she was very agitated. P.S. At 2 in the morning, he came in, so everything was okay. But for a while there, it looked like, you know, she was very upset that he was missing. And I even had, and this sounds silly, but it was so striking, I even had a pair of ducks that were always roaming around in our yard. And one day, one of the ducks got sick and died at the end of that day. And they had been really inseparable. And the female just called and called and looked all over mm-hmm. the place and for many, many days. And then finally, as we all do when we lose somebody, you know, she just had to sort of get back to life and routine. But it was very striking that she was really looking for him. She really understood, you know, very clearly that he was not there, and she was trying to find him.
We're speaking about animals' feelings, thoughts, behaviors with Carl Safina. He's a conservationist and award-winning author, and he is the founding president of the Safina Center at Stony Brook University, where he's the inaugural holder of the Endowed Chair for Nature and Humanity. And we're discussing his book, his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Take a short break. We'll be right back.
And we return to Monday's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with Dr. Carl Safina. He's joining us from Stony Brook, New York. We're talking about his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Carl Safina, In your book, you describe accompanying and meeting some of the best authorities on wolf behavior. It was quite an experience. Give us some of the highlights of just the physical aspect of that and how dedicated these people are in Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mainly a guy named Rick McIntyre, who is a ranger and researcher there, and he has been out with the wolves every day for 15 years, and I don't mean every day that it's nice weather, and I don't mean 5 days a week. I mean every single day for 15 years, he has gone into the park looking for and mostly looking at wolves that are now again living in Yellowstone Park after not being there for 60 years.
Before we get to the wolves, I just wanted to ask you generally, you talk about so many animals in your book, but why did you focus on the killer whales, wolves, and elephants? What drew you to those three animals?
Yeah, because I asked myself, that's a great question, I asked myself, what are the other creatures in the world who have structured social groups where they really know other individuals and they know who they are? They know who their friends are. They all know each other in the group, and they aspire to higher status, and their lives follow the arc of a career. You know, who are these other animals? And there are a few, and I wanted to choose three, so I chose elephants and wolves and killer whales because I wanted to try to get a range. You know, I didn't want them all to be like wolves and wild dogs and things like that. I wanted them to be different from one another. So those are the ones that I chose. If the human mind had an endless capacity to absorb information, I could have had six or eight. But I always think three. You know, give an example, state a principle, and give three examples is a good way to go.
Okay. Well, getting back to the wolves and Rick McIntyre, you said you had the strangest conversation in your life with him, and it concerned Wolf 21 and Casanova. Would you tell us about that?
Because yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good story. So he starts out by saying, why doesn't Batman just kill the Joker so he doesn't have to deal with him? And we're looking through telescopes at wolves that are about a mile away, and the whole time he's talking, he's not taking his eye out of his telescope, and he's trying to tell me something about wolves by using these superheroes. And it's a way of sort of backing into a really, really interesting story. They name the wolves there after the number on their research collar, so they just refer to them by the research collar number mostly. And one of the wolves had a collar 21, so he was referred to as 21, as though that was his name. And this wolf really distinguished himself in two ways. One is that in a lifetime that involved having plenty of fights with wolves from rival packs, he never was beaten. He always won every fight. And yet, the other way he distinguished himself was that he never killed another wolf that he had beaten. And that's very unusual. But that's the way that he lived, and he died on his own terms of old age. And in his life, at one point, there was another wolf who was nicknamed Casanova because he would just wander around among different packs, and he had sort of wolf charisma. All the females found him irresistible. And one day, 21 finds Casanova among his daughters in his own pack there. And this is an intolerable situation. So he immediately attacks. And Casanova was also a really big wolf, but as Rick said, but he was a bad fighter. And 21 was a consummate fighter. So when wolves begin to fight, usually all the surrounding wolves take sides and join in. And everybody quickly overwhelms Casanova, and the next most logical thing would be that they kill him. But suddenly, 21 simply stops, and everybody simply then steps back and looks at him as if to say, why has Dad stopped? What's going on here? And Casanova takes the opportunity to jump up and flee. But he continued to cause problems and aggravation for 21, and yet 21 never killed him. So the question is, why? And after 21 died of old age, Casanova became the leader of his own pack. Casanova was, as I said, a bad fighter, and one day a fight broke out with a rival pack. The rival pack killed him, but in his defense of his own pack, all of his own pack had managed to escape. And among those wolves that escaped were the grandchildren of Wolf 21. Mm. So by not killing Casanova, he had assured a vehicle for his legacy in this other wolf that wound up being the guardian and protector of his own grandchildren.
Could he have had consciousness of that when he let Casanova go the first time?
I am pretty sure we can say that he could not possibly have thought of anything along those lines. So why doesn't Batman kill the Joker is the question. And the point is, why is it that people sometimes are magnanimous? And why is it that people sometimes show mercy? And there are a couple of different things about that. One is that if you have beaten a rival and you show mercy, that's even more impressive in the eyes of the individuals around you. Your own status grows by not killing your rival, by showing that you have such strength and such confidence that you can let your rival go free. And the other thing is that sometimes your rival becomes later on your ally, and sometimes your rival becomes a vehicle for your own interests later in your own legacy. So where do these impulses among people come from, these impulses to be magnanimous and these impulses to be merciful? That these may be something that deep in our psyche, you know, we don't think about it when we do something altruistic for somebody else. The thinking has already happened in the calculations of evolution, and evolution hands it to us on a cheat sheet called motivations. So when we're motivated to be magnanimous or we're motivated to do something altruistic, that comes from somewhere deep within us, and it may be that this is exactly where it comes from, that if you can afford to be, it can sometimes really pay off in the long run, even though we don't understand it much better than a wolf might.
How about human-raised wolves, for whatever reason? How do they differ from those in the wild?
Well, when people raise wolves, you can end up with tame wolves, but they're still wolves. You know, they're just captive. They're not very good as far as really following humans like dogs are. And dogs are domesticated wolves. They're entirely descended from wolves, but they're changed in the process of domestication. And among those changes are that they can eat a human diet, they key into their human leaders as the leaders, and they feel very comfortable in our homes. I've been told by people who raise wolves that wolves can never be housebroken, for instance. So that would not work out too well. Wolves do get remarkably, remarkably tame. I mean, much more like dogs than I was expecting to see. So that struck me as very interesting. And another thing that I was struck by while observing free-living wolves, really, really wild wolves, is that so many of the behaviors that our dogs show to us, the excited greetings and the submissive postures, rolling on the belly, wagging the tails, looking to us for cues about what we're going to do next, all of those things I saw in wolf packs, but it's mostly the younger wolves. A pack of wolves is only is very simply just a family. It's two breeders and their children from the last 2 or 3 years. And then as the young ones get to be mature, they leave and they try to form their own packs.
So all
the other ones are their children. So they look to their adults the way that our dogs look to us. But at some point, a wolf gets to be the captain of their own fate. You know, they have to take charge of their own lives. Our dogs never get that chance.
I was just going to ask you, when you were saying they sometimes go off on their own and form their own packs, do they ever become rivals with their family?
The short answer is yes, but the longer answer is it gets complicated. Let's just say that a wolf leaves their family, and they go and they meet up with another wolf, and then those wolves have pups, and then they have their own pack. That pack may be at odds with the one that one came from as far as defending their territory and fighting with them, but they won't fight very hard with wolves that they know as individuals very well. So even if there was a fight that broke out, they wouldn't be inclined to turn on and fight with their own parents and siblings.
Okay.
And so there are so many parallels between the way wolf groups and wolf families act toward one another and the rivalries and feuds that we see in human families that it gets, to me, it was just super, super interesting.
Well, we're going to talk more about them, and we're going to get to the killer whales, which are pretty fascinating, and the elephants as well, with Carl Safina, a conservationist, award-winning author. And he also co-chairs the universities of at Stony Brook's Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. He's written Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Monday edition. We resume our conversation about animal behavior and their emotional lives with Dr. Carl Safina. His book is Beyond Words. Carl, you say in the book that dogs weren't domesticated by humans, but domesticated themselves. Could you clarify that?
Right. At first, yes. It seems that from the best that we know now is that wolves hung around human habitations, you know, caves and camps and things like that.
This is hunter-gatherer era?
Yes, yeah. Very early when humans were hunter-gatherers, wolves would hang around to feed on scraps from carcasses and butchered animals and bones and things like that. There was a lot of extra food around humans, so wolves hung around. And some of the wolves were, just because of genetic predisposition, just a little bit less shy, a little bit bolder, and would come a little closer and get more of the food, and they would do better, and they would be able to raise more young. And that this trait of being in close proximity to people, rather than being afraid of them, was therefore a self-reinforcing thing that resulted in more and more individuals who hung around humans more and more. And eventually, they probably, you know, began guarding that area, so they would begin performing the guarding functions that we still use dogs for a lot, barking at strangers, alerting that there were strangers approaching, guarding our places and our young and our people in that way, following us on hunts, and probably at some point us following them on hunts and sharing parts of kills and we're talking now a process that probably took tens of thousands of years. Not 5 years or 10 years, but more like 15 or 20,000 years. These animals were changed enough to be what we consider to be the first dogs, rather than wolves. And then, then of course, as we had dogs that were much more fully integrated into our own social groups, we began much more actively breeding different breeds. But that came much, much later. And it seems that, the dogs followed or accompanied human groups as humans spread over much of the earth. So our relationship with dogs is really, really amazing, and there's no other animal that we've had a relationship like that with.
Well, I don't want to leave the dogs necessarily, but I do want to get to the whales and the elephants. So Moving along to the killer whales, you say that they possess the most incredible minds of any of the animals you studied. So tell us about that and some of those great stories about their ability to reason and figure things out.
Yeah, they really blew me away. I was very well prepared to find smart animals and animals that had deep bonds and things like that. But I was not prepared for animals that seemed to spontaneously help people. Killer whales in the wild have never harmed a human being. And there are a couple of very well-documented stories of researchers who were following groups of killer whales, and these were groups that they knew very well. They had names for all of them. They knew exactly who they were. The killer whales were familiar with the researchers. They were quite familiar with their boats and the sound of their voices and that kind of thing. And they were following them around, studying their behavior. When in each of these two cases, they became completely lost in the fog. In one case, they kind of knew what direction to go in. In the other case, the person didn't even have a compass on the boat and was really, really lost and didn't know what to do. And in both cases, the whales that they had been following that they had lost came to the boat. In the first case, where they had a compass, they had started more or less in the direction that they thought home was. And this was many years ago before there was Loran or GPS. And in just a couple of minutes after they started running, the whales came in and were all around in front of the boat as though they were leading them. So they simply followed the whales. They followed them for 15 miles, and when they suddenly burst through the fog, the researcher's house was on the shoreline directly ahead of them. Yeah. And then the whales simply left. And the second story is very, very similar. That person hadn't even started the boat yet because they didn't know what direction to go in, and the whales that they had been having a hard time following. They felt that the whales were being a little elusive that day, but those whales showed up right alongside the boat, swimming around the boat in circles, and then they developed a little bit of directionality. The people started the engine. They followed in the direction that the whales seemed to want to lead them. And similarly, they got led through the fog until they could see out of the fog, and their home in the place where they moored the boat was directly ahead of them. There are other stories that are even a lot weirder. There are two stories where people were camping on tiny islands and they went out in kayaks and came back, and the dog that they had left on the little island was not there anymore. And the dog apparently thought that they had been accidentally left or abandoned, and must have tried following the kayaks, that the people didn't realize that the dog had left the island. And late into the night, these sad people, they're crying and mourning the loss of their dog and feeling absolutely horrible. And they hear the sound of killer whales, and the whales pass by. These are two separate instances with two separate dogs, two separate groups of people on two separate islands in British Columbia. And the killer whales pass by, and then suddenly there's the dog coming ashore, splashing through the shallows, vomiting salt water, sodden and chilled. And in each case, the people were absolutely convinced that the killer whales had saved their dog. Hmm. Now, that's a very, very strange story.
Right.
And there are a couple of other stories that are a little less strange, and I would say a lot more touching. There was a very young killer whale that got lost and wound up deep up a fjord in British Columbia, far from the sound of its family, many, many miles, like 30 miles up this fjord. And it stayed up there for 6 years, and it was lonely, and it frequently sought people out to play with. And if it wanted to play with a 30-foot sailboat, it would give a big shove to the boat. But if it wanted to play with two women in a kayak, it would give the tiniest tap. Now, it's inexplicable to me how in the world a killer whale might ever suspect that it would be bad for two women to wind up in that cold water where the whale is completely at home, never feels cold, and things like that. One of the other stories about killer whales, one of the researchers, there was another lost killer whale, and that one was not too terribly far from its family. They actually got it back to the family, but the researcher that found it playing with a floating branch, and he picked up the branch and he threw it, and the killer whale immediately went and got the branch and brought it back to the boat. And now this is a completely wild killer whale, immediately engaging in play with the researcher on the boat. So he said to me, and then I did something really silly. I made a circular motion with my finger, like roll over, and the killer whale immediately rolled over. And he thought, that's absolutely astonishing, because to get a dog to do that, you have to train them that, you know, that's a hand signal that you're using to make the dog do this kind of movement with its body. But the killer whale immediately intuited that motion had to do with the motion of its own body around the axis of its body, and it had to want to engage with the researcher and had to have a sense of playfulness in doing that. So all of these incidents and some of these very, very strange stories about killer whales made them, to me, very, very mysterious and really, like, inexplicable why they would engage like this, why they would never hurt people when people have hurt them so much. So really, totally amazing creatures.
Before we do have another short break we need to take, but before we take it, what are your thoughts about the SeaWorld incident where the killer whale did kill the trainer?
That particular killer whale had been involved in three human fatalities. In that last one, it was very clear that whale alone killed that trainer. But that whale had been very badly abused in another place where it had been kept for a long time, and had probably gotten a bit psychotic over the years from the abuse that it had endured. It also looked to me like the whale missed a cue that the trainer thought she had. Well, the trainer had given a cue, and the whale seemed to miss it. And the whale thought it did what it had been asked to do and expected a reward, and the trainer withheld the reward because, in her eyes, the whale had not done what she asked. So it seemed to be a misunderstanding. And one of the things I take from that is only two creatures with minds that are capable of understanding are capable of having a misunderstanding.
Right.
But that whale, with all the abuse and all the other stuff in its history, may at that point simply have been rather frustrated and gotten kind of carried away with that. Whether he was simply carried away or whether he actually was frustrated enough to intend to kill her, I don't know. But that was a horrible thing, and not a thing that has ever happened in the wild, where killer whales are with their families, being who they are, in a place where they belong.
We're speaking with Carl Safina. He's a conservationist and an award-winning author. His latest book, which isn't really not about conservation, it's about animals, beyond words, what they think and what they feel. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Carl Safina. We're talking about his book, Beyond Words. Carl, we have little time left, and we still haven't gotten really to elephants, which is a tremendous part of your book. But even before we do that, in the book, you talk about the intelligence of some birds actually rival primates, especially ravens. Elaborate on that just a bit.
Yeah, the tool-making, tool-using behavior and social behavior of some birds is equal to, or in a couple of cases exceeds, what people have seen with apes. So we like to think that apes are the smartest things that aren't us because they look like us and because they are smart. But there are a lot of other really smart things out there that we don't know them very well. That's why we're surprised by it. But they've been doing that for millions of years.
Okay, elephants. We can't not get to elephants. In fact,
yes,
I went on the website this
morning.
Yeah, let's get to elephants. So you worked with Ian Douglas Hamilton, who's the founder of Save the Elephants, and Cynthia Moss, and they've been studying them for 40 years. So
yes.
I would say they are pretty good sources to have gone to. Tell us just a little bit about them.
The most amazing thing is that some of the elephants that they are studying, they have known for 40 years.
Mm.
Those elephants were there when they first got there, and some of them are still there. And these people are just, they're magnificent people, just such insightful observers, and so wonderfully patient, and they've learned so much. And they've given us such a different view of what life is like out there, and these other kinds of animals that live such vivid lives with their families and know who they are and who their families and friends are. And we know about that because of these two people mainly.
And those are incredible things about how they can tell a friend and a foe by even what they wear. Tell us just a little about that.
Humans.
Yes, they can tell the difference between the clothing or the sound of the recorded conversations of humans that never hurt them, like tourists, and humans that sometimes do hurt them, like the herders that come and go, that often get into trouble with elephants at waterholes and sometimes throw spears at them and hurt them or kill them. Elephants know that if they hear recorded conversation of tourists coming out of speakers, they ignore it. But if they hear the language of the herders in these recordings, they react with fright and they bunch up and eventually they leave. And the same thing with the clothing worn by such people left on trails. Elephants will ignore things, ignore clothes that smell like tourists, and will run in fright from clothes that smell like the people who hurt them. They know what's going on.
Have you heard about these efforts of some people to dye the elephant tusks pink in an effort to discourage the poachers? Do you know if that's true?
It's not true. No.
Uh-huh.
It's an idea, and it's a nice idea that would be impossible. It would be impossible because you would have to, for one thing, knock down thousands of elephants and somehow try to figure out how to dye their tusks.
And they're so observant, how would they react to them?
Right.
I mean, you couldn't possibly knock out thousands of elephants. It's not, you wouldn't be able to, you know, you'd have to be hunting elephants all the time and creating constant chaos just with the idea of anesthetizing all those elephants.
Right.
And there is not the money or the manpower there's nothing that it would take. It just doesn't exist. So those photographs are completely faked.
Okay. You write that the issue of self-awareness in animals, and we can do it through, you know, you can illustrate this through an elephant. You say it's a point of great confusion for humans, which you don't understand. So let's define what this consciousness or self-awareness is, and then you can apply it to elephants.
Right. Well, consciousness is simply the experience of something that feels like something. If you feel anything, you're conscious. When you get total anesthesia and you don't feel anything and you have no mental experience, you are no longer conscious. And then you come back to consciousness. But that's what consciousness is. It's the thing that feels like something. The part of our brain that actually allows us to have sensations. And many, many animals simply have those mental experiences. It's very obvious from the fact that they use their judgment, that they flee in danger, or that they attack in rage, that they're very aware of what they're doing and where they are in their home territories. Same thing with self-awareness. This is something that people seem so confused about, that only humans have self-awareness. Well, self-awareness is the understanding that you are an individual different from other individuals and different from the environment that you live in. And other animals could hardly survive if they didn't understand the difference between themselves and another individual. They would never be able to find a mate or actually carry out mating or care for their young ones or defend their territory against rivals or run from predators if they didn't have self-awareness. A wolf that was eating the leg of an elk and didn't have the ability to distinguish between the leg of an elk and biting into its own leg would not survive. So all of these animals are aware that they are individuals different from other individuals.
And they feel pain, and they feel fear, and they feel joy. And
yes, it's quite obvious that they do, because they act that way in appropriate circumstances that make complete sense to us. An animal that is playing with its babies that seems joyful doesn't suddenly scream in pain because it's not feeling any pain. But if you hurt it, it can scream in pain. Or if something suddenly is very dangerous, it will run in fear. It won't suddenly panic if nothing has happened and everything is okay. If nothing has happened and everything is okay, it will be relaxed. So its responses make complete sense, and that's how we understand that its experience is very similar to our experience under the same circumstances.
How about animal planning? To me, that seems to be the one of your premises that is most difficult for me to understand. How far ahead do they plan? Do they plan what they're going to hunt next weekend? How far does it go?
No, I don't think they do, and I don't think that was a premise that I put forward. I think I actually said that I think the ability for other animals to plan ahead doesn't extend very far. But the same is true for tribal people as well. What is a human mind is different from what is a human mind in America today with calendars and phones and a sense of the way that we structure our time and our careers and things like that. But for most of history, people have lived in small groups within about a 10-square-mile block. They didn't understand much about the world outside of that or the rival tribes around them. And what they needed to know was, let's go hunting now. Not much more than what we're going to do tomorrow.
Not planning for retirement.
Not planning for retirement or who they're, where they're going to go to college. So I think with animals, I think it's kind of similar. They can plan ahead a little bit. They can plan to go home. They're traveling homeward. They know where they're going. They will think that, later we're going to do this, but probably not much more than the next.
We didn't plan to run so long, and we've done so.
Well, Carl Safino, we thank you so much for being with us. Beyond-words.net is the website for the book. CarlSafina.org is Carl Safina's website. Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Bonnie and Joseph, thank you very, very much for having me. I wish we could have talked about this for a lot longer.
Me too.
Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow's topic of current, you might want to learn about money or valuables that you can claim from the state of Florida's Bureau of Unclaimed Property. We'll have more information tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.